Good evening, fellow citizens of this divine enterprise. Time to let your arms snake loose. Time to pry open that third eye hole. Stretch that polyphonic mind muscle. We are the card-carrying psychedelic jive journey of the universe. Let it flow. Like a domino fallen, we're calling you out of that flesh and bone ride you call a body, timeless. That great glowing cacophony, that storm where your consciousness was born. Dial down deeper, 'cause if you finger truths like the ace of spades, your house of cards is built to fall. Let it all fall. All those truths you've castled yourself into, no time to lose, no time to gain. Raise your arms, psychic trailblazers, bound by the holy pyrotechnics of the soul. Time to trespass positively beyond the do not enter signs posted around your vulnerabilities and merge with us. No overlords here to boss you around, no caste system keeping you down, no promise of heaven, no fear of hell. No pendulum swinging between two neon signs, one blinking yes and the other no. 'Cause all that we are behind this fantasy dreamlight express, we call waking life, is yes. Yes. Yes.
It's December 8th, Saturday, 3 p.m. Welcome to Merge Radio, Eugene. We have an excellent episode today. We're doing a slice of life piece. I went around Eugene this week just to see what Eugene had to offer in terms of art and in terms of nonprofits and in terms of activism. And it was not difficult to find amazing people. I find myself in constant admiration for the people in Eugene, for their mentalities, for what they do. I want to thank everyone for interviewing with me and spending time with me. Just sit back and enjoy what Eugene has to offer.
What is Merge Radio? Merge Radio is about the power of radical ideas and communicating those ideas to as many people who are interested in questioning reality as it is offered to us. We do not hold reverence for ideas themselves, only for truth, so let us explore these ideas together, trailblazing the paths of free thinking and removing the chains of rhetoric that have been locked tight around us at birth. Who are we as a society? Why do we act the way we do? Can we dream of a world in which we can choose to be who we want and have real freedom? I say hell motherfucking yes. Humans are empowered with a will to determine their own course. We have that power unless we give it to someone else. So let's take our power and do something so radically free as to think outside of the boxes offered to our young, vulnerable minds at birth. Time to question the validity of our cultures and imagine ourselves becoming truly free. Together.
Merge Radio is a Hearts and Crimes production produced locally here in Eugene, Oregon, by yours truly, Argus. Merge Radio is created for the enlightenment of all beings, to start important conversations, and to disseminate vital information across the greater Eugene area. Do not taunt Merge Radio. For immediate effect, apply Merge Radio liberally onto the inflamed parts of your hearts, minds, and pineal glands. Merge Radio.
So I'm here in the heart of the Whitaker, in front of the Red Barn grocery store, natural food store. Happened upon a wonderful sounding musician. What's your name?
Sly David.
Sly. And what is it you have here? What sort of instrument?
A guitar.
Yeah, I notice you got a... What is this little piece here called?
It's a brass tube.
It's a brass tube for playing, I'm guessing, the slide guitar.
That'd be correct.
Yeah, I noticed you playing it. It sounded amazing. I was hoping you'd play a few songs for us.
Yeah, sure.
Do you have any names for the songs that you want to play, this first one?
This first one is called God's Cure.
God's Cure.
Yeah, it's about, you know, switching from today's conventional Western medicine over, you know, more towards the herbal, you know.
Homeopathy and such?
Yeah. Using the plants that are already here, the medicines that are already here, to heal ourselves.
Right on, let's hear it.
Children that are giving hell, but that kid's got no problem. Put him on a pill. Boy, he's doing the studies, but still something wrong. Well, turn you away, cause every motion change can't get from a pill. Give your children wild like there's something great. Well, give them the cure that God made. Set it up, poison, and recommend first.
That sounded awesome. So, this gentleman's name is Sly. What do you think of his music?
I like it.
What about it do you like?
All of it.
He's
got a good blues voice. Yeah, he does.
He certainly does. Could you tell us what the name of your next song is?
This next one's Treading Through Muddy Water.
Treading Through Muddy Water.
Treading Through Muddy Waters.
Great.
Thank you.
mind. And my hand on my guitar, my peace of mind.
That was amazing. Now, do you have any advice for musicians, young musicians who are interested in traveling and just what the lifestyle is like and ways to express themselves?
You get what you get and you give what you got. And you know, you keep with that and be good. And, you know, keep playing your guitar. You know, stay true.
Right on. And this last song, what's the name of it?
This is a song called "Dead Man Walking."
Dead Man Walking.
Yeah, it's one I wrote about a friend of mine, Frankie Lynn. Met him. He's a busker down in San Francisco. And the bar stations, you know, and man, he died three times up until, four times, you know, the fourth one killed him.
Wow.
Yeah. Third time he died, he woke up dead on the mortician's table and signed his death certificate. So he's legally dead, therefore dead man walking.
Right, makes sense.
Dead Man Walking.
Started singing the blues, hold his head up high, raise his hand in the long, with a dead man walking, running like he never seen. Morning at to stop this freight train. Hold his head up high, raise his hand to the Lord. Where is that man walking around like he never seen?
Wow. Well, that's an amazing blues sound. Thank you so much for playing for us, Sly.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. Anytime, man.
So I'm sitting here in the heart of the Whitaker at Reality Kitchen, a local venue that has been having open mics for months, as well as serving the community's youth. Individuals with disabilities and vocational rehabilitation. And I'm here with Jim Evangelista, and we're going to talk to him about what Reality Kitchen does, a little bit of the history, and where it's going. So first of all, I want to say, hey, how's it going, Jim?
Hey now, Argus. It's good being with you today.
And so would you please tell us a little bit about the history of Reality Kitchen and what the vision is for this this place?
You know, we've been here now 2 years, here on Van Buren at 245 Van Buren, right here in the heart of the beautiful Whitaker neighborhood. Pretty grateful to be here. Reality Kitchen's history started way back in, kind of hard to place where it started, you know? I worked at the Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Strip, and there they had a big checkerboard around the building, and I got really inspired. I thought, what a beautiful front for a building. You come here now and you look at the checkerboard we have here. Well, that checkerboard was on the Reality Kitchen that we had back in Gainesville, Florida.
And when was that?
Of course, I'm going to give a shout out to all the friends in Gainesville. Back in 1982, we started Reality Kitchen. Then it was a 24-hour restaurant and coffee house, kind of a restaurant of the mind. A lot of people gathered there. We produced a newspaper out of the back room. We had all kinds of events, music. Monday night was punk night. Tuesday was community night. Wednesday night was open mic night. Thursday we had folk night, you know, and folk musicians from all over the community. Friday and Saturday were live bands, reggae, blues, or jazz was Sunday, and on Monday I brought the punks back in to sweep the cobwebs clean. It was funny, the other night I was listening on NPR to an interview with Ian McKay. Ian McKay from Minor Threat. Well, I remember serving six packs in a couple of cases, in fact, to Minor Threat back at Reality Kitchen in 1982. So that was a little bit before Straight Edge. That was the Black Sheep tour. Well, that was the kind of place that we had. We had everybody in the community coming through. Well, I've been a freelance artist all my life. I paint murals, I do public artwork, I paint scenery, theater, all kinds of production work, all my life. And at one point, living in Florida wasn't going to happen, so we just had a new family, and we got in our school bus and traveled west, and of course the first thing we did was we hit the country fair here. It was 1992, so I had the family with the dog and the school bus, and we landed at the fair. We'd been given these camping passes that we hung around our necks, and we got in and said, oh my God, they let people do this here? This is incredible. I can't wait to see what the rest of the community is like. Well, we started painting murals. I did a mural over at 12th and High, a Tuscany mural that a lot of folks know, and many other murals locally. Well, it gave me an opportunity to get to know the community more intimately and for more from a street level perspective. And I got to see what a wonderful and vibrant community Eugene was then, is now. Somewhere along the way, I got back into academia and I got my master's in special education. When I got out, I started working for Lane ESD, working in life skills classroom as a teacher and an educational assistant, and working with students with all kinds of challenges. But consistently, I saw that art, theater, music, creativity was the single thread that lifted people up and that people were able to express themselves. At a point in time, I saw that what I was doing in the transition program, working for Lane ESD, 18 to 21 year olds, I saw that creativity, or more creative and thoughtful and out-of-the-box response to some of their needs and challenges, was really what was important. And many of us got together in the classroom there and started theorizing about and reflecting about how important it would be to have a place where young adults with developmental disabilities, those 21 and older, could come and have more of a workplace setting experience, a place where they could accomplish learning in a more intimate and meaningful way than what they've been given in the transition classrooms.
So what are some of the projects that the youth have been working on with you?
Well, what we determined to do and how we're making projects happen here is to create an academic kitchen where students could learn the kinds of skills in a workplace setting that they would need to be independent successfully in the rest of their lives. Now, that's just a backdrop, and that is the core of what now is Reality Kitchen here in Van Buren in the Whitaker neighborhood. What we do is we work with young adults with developmental disabilities, and we teach them kitchen prep school skills, menu planning, how to do the food, and also we take it another step. We find a way to integrate the rest of the larger community into the activities that the students have. We do some theater here. We have performance. And as you mentioned, we have open mics. We have karaoke here. We have different kinds of activities that we include and make available the opportunities for integration and inclusion, community inclusion, with our student population, with the larger community. So the goals here at Reality Kitchen, this version, is to create a true inclusive community space where all people with and without disabilities can gather together, be thoughtful, be creative, be open and inclusive. And we find that it's working out pretty well.
And your open mics, often called acoustic reality, could you speak to about the nature of the acoustic sound here in Eugene as it's been developed and expressed here by local musicians at Reality Kitchen?
You know, people's response to the times, to their own circumstances, has always been, you know, what makes artists and musicians very distinctive. And here in Eugene, we certainly have a good smattering of incredibly gifted and incredibly passionate and talented individuals. What I'm grateful for is that they are finding that because we are not a bar, because we're not one of those other locations that that they maybe will do open mics and have gatherings and activities, which are all good spaces too. But the atmosphere that we are providing here in this space allows people to be very comfortable, to offer their intimacy, and to offer themselves in a different way, more accessible and meaningful way. The space, again, is very intimate that we have, and it sounds like musicians are bringing their best and their most thought-provoking and thoughtful expressions. And so we're grateful. What we've done is, certainly over this last year, we've started recording all of these events, these gatherings. You know, we've had a cross-section of different kinds of events, everything from our open mics to bringing Max Rameau in from the East Coast here to speak to the challenges of homelessness and foreclosure and the need for people to be more empowered, taking back the land, taking back our lives. And I think in small ways, in meaningful ways, in day-to-day ways, and in larger ways, that's what Reality Kitchen is trying to offer the community right now.
And you're planning a large open mic gathering for the holidays on December 17th. Could you speak to that a little bit?
You know, we're inviting everybody to come and share the evening with us. We'll have a potluck, which doesn't mean that you have to bring food to come. But it's going to be an open gathering. It's our way of saying thank you and enjoying the holidays with everyone. Those with needs of all kinds and in need in all ways, and bringing whatever they can, both food, love, heart, music, sharing some time, some fellowship together. And that's going to be on December 17th, as you said.
And what time? And could you state the address of Reality Kitchen?
Yeah, it's going to be at 7:30. The potluck, we're going to start up around 6:30. Word is we're going to have a turkey and all the dressings, as well as everything else that you can imagine. And food and drink and music starting up at 7:30. Oh, it's just on time, that train. That's another reason why I love being in the Whittaker. And it's here.
And where is it again?
Here we are at 245 Van Buren. As you can hear, Ninkasi Brewery is right across the street from us. You know, they're unloading crates and bottles and things. So, but yeah, it's going to be a wonderful night. We're really looking forward to bringing people together and to share some warmth at this chill time.
And also, you mentioned that the open mics have been recorded. Is there any work being done to make a show for that?
Well, I would say that you, Argus, and a number of different folks are coming together, and we're going to put this radio show together. We're going to try and do a regular offering of acoustic reality. All the music and words and thoughts and experiences of Reality Kitchen. And it's going to speak to the needs of people with and without developmental disabilities.
And if people would like to get involved with Reality Kitchen, what ways could they help support?
You know, the best way to check out what's going on at Reality Kitchen is come on down here to 245 Van Buren. But if you're going to do it digitally, you can go check us out online at realitykitchen.org. You can email us at realitykitchen@gmail. Lots of ways to plug in. We have a calendar so you can see what's happening online. You can come on in and visit with us anytime. We're making food. Catherine makes some incredible doll soup, and there's some wonderful food coming out of that kitchen right now. And so much of it is produced by our students. We're really grateful, and I want to say right now, to CALC, the Community Alliance of Lane County, has been our fiscal sponsor for some time now, so that it helps us through the period that now we've just completed our paperwork for the IRS to be finalized as a 501c3. So everyone's donations and support to Reality Kitchen is tax deductible in these lean times. In many ways you can plug in, and we invite you to come on down.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Right on. Happy trails.
That's 98.5 KHAC Merge Radio.
There is an aspect of the human experience that is neither thought nor is it emotion, but a combination of the two, that when expressed to the utmost power creates a waveform of energy with a constant and recycling inertia. That is you falling into yourself. That is you finding the unconditional truth of your purpose. That is the unity of heart and mind. That is why we sing.
So I'm standing here near the corner of 8th and Pearl Street in downtown Eugene. This is the home of the old City Hall that has been closed down and girded with a $70,000 fence to keep people out. Hi. Excuse me. Do you mind if... I mean, it's just for a little radio thing we're doing here. And I'd like to ask you if you have heard about the memorial for the individuals who were homeless and died in Eugene.
I have not heard about it.
Well, this is the list of people who have, in each one represented by a tag, who have died by exposure in Eugene. Were you aware about that people were dying in the street?
Yes.
Well, if you don't mind, what have you heard about it?
Well, just from what I've seen personally and some of the stuff that we We worked with the Osberg, and we did a hunger and homelessness drive. So some of the stats that I've read about Lane County as a whole, with 39% of Lane County is hungry or homeless, stuff like that.
Right. And there's a statistic going around that something like 4 out of 6 families in America are one paycheck or two paychecks away from losing their homes. Do you know, have you experienced that? Do you know any people that have experienced that?
Not per se. I mean, I've heard a lot about it, but not on a personal level.
What have you heard about it, if you don't mind me asking?
Just that there's a lot of people that are, you know, in our country that are going hungry and homeless, and people are having to foreclose on houses and, you know, scrape by, work 4 jobs just to be able to pay a mortgage off and stuff like that.
Right. And it seems to me that I don't want to make this question too leading, that the middle class have been facing a very large struggle, as if the term I've heard is they're being squeezed. Do you
there
have any
really
feelings
no
about that?
Class anymore. There really is no middle class anymore. I mean, there's the elitist upper class, and then there's the lower middle class, if there is even a lower middle class. I mean, the middle class is not a... It used to be the working class, and now it's kind of, you know... There's no middle class. They are being squeezed.
And how does that make you feel?
I mean, it sucks. Yeah. Honestly. I mean, I was raised in a middle class family, and, you know, being a college student, it's hard being a middle class college student, because you either, you know, especially with financial aid, they don't give you financial aid if you, you know, make a certain amount of money. But then if you don't make enough money, then it's like that middle ground where you're kind of just stuck. It's like being the middle child.
And, well, sorry, what were you majoring in?
English and creative writing.
English and creative writing, and fellow writer. I'm a poet myself. My name is Argus. Oh, do you mind if I use your name, or shall I not?
That's fine.
Okay. So, can you say your name?
Max Pritchett.
And how long have you been living in Eugene?
About 6 months.
6 months. And where are you from originally, if you don't mind me asking?
Kansas City.
And what brought you to the University of Oregon?
Eugene, actually.
What about Eugene?
Just the open-mindedness and the cultural diversity of this city.
Right.
And the University of Oregon, of course.
Cool. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your comments.
Yep.
Have a great one.
You too.
I'm going to read a list of names here. These are the individuals who died from exposure, homeless individuals who died out in the streets. And this is in Eugene between 2011 and 2012. And each of these is on a white piece of paper that's been, it looks like some photo paper of some sort. It's holding up very well in these crazy Eugene weather. I'll read the list. We have Bonnie Trader, Jesse Brown, Dale Gaynor, Space Cowboy, Dana Crippen, Jennifer Linney, Rick Youngblood. We have Mark here with no last name. We've got Craig, in quotes, Cat Gable. Craig Cat Gable. We have Brian Powell. Brian Powell. Suzette Husk. Darren McEldowney. Rick Jackson. James W. Hawkins, Ken Brazale, Cloud, James Smith, Duke Cantrell, Billy, Jennifer Sells. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 names on this fence. In front of the city offices, the former City Hall of Eugene. I'm sitting out here with Gwendolyn Maeve, who, well, I guess you tied yourself, you chained yourself to City Hall. When did you do that?
Action began the 17th of November, but I actually chained myself to the fence around City Hall. That they put up to keep people out of the building after they vacated it.
And could you tell us a little bit about the fence, the cost involved, and the rationale the city gave you, or gave everyone, why the fence was put up?
Well, when the city offices vacated the building, there was some talk beginning about certain promises the city had made. Last year at the close of the Occupy Eugene site, there had been a lot of discussion about solutions for the homeless situation we have here in Eugene. And one of the things the city said they were going to do was allocate $100,000 towards building a wet bed facility and certain other homeless needs. And that never happened.
Before we go on, could you explain to us what a wet bed is and what that would mean for the city of Eugene?
A wet bed facility is somewhere where somebody who is intoxicated on any kind of substance is still welcome to go and sleep in a warm place so that they do not freeze to death while they're out on the streets. Which so far we only have one very small facility in the city of Eugene that provides that, and they only provide that for people long enough for them to sober up. So once they are no longer intoxicated, they are put back out on the street because they don't have enough resources to do any more than that for people.
Okay. And could you talk more about the fence and why you chained yourself to the fence surrounding City Hall, the old City Hall?
Yes. So the $100,000 that they promised last year is the backstory to the conversation that started happening among activists and using the old City Hall building as a possible emergency shelter for people on nights that it started getting very cold, considering it was just going to be sitting there empty. And it was a public building. The lights are on in it. And even though the city no longer does steam heat, there's still electric hooked up to the building, and the electric heaters could be brought in for emergency situations when the nights get cold to house people. And as soon as that conversation started happening in public forums on the internet and in person, and people I think actually went and looked at the building itself while this conversation was going on, within a couple weeks of that, a fence went up around the building. Basically, they were afraid that we were going to occupy the space, so they decided to keep us out. And that alone is what sparked my interest in doing an action where I locked down to on the wrong side of the fence at City Hall to bring awareness to the issue of them not only not coming through on their promises to the community about the homeless solutions that we had been talking about, but their willingness to spend money to keep people out of public space that could potentially be used. Then we uncovered how much the fence cost.
Which was how much?
$70,000.
Whoa, that sounds like that $70,000 could have very easily be spent on, for instance, a wet bed program.
That definitely could have been. That would have been the majority of the amount already promised to us. And the fact that they were so willing to spend that kind of money on a fence, which represents basically keeping people out in the cold, but they still were not able to come through. And we're talking the middle of November here, so there was no site. There was no plan in place for actually creating this wet bed facility that had been talked about by the middle of November. And the fact that they thought that they were going to get it done, or wanted the public to think that they were going to get it done in time for the cold nights, was just ridiculous. So the fact that they were able to put that fence up in just a couple of days using $70,000 of the taxpayer money, and they couldn't use that money to keep people from dying on the street, really infuriated myself and quite a few other people in the community that are homeless advocates, homeless people, and homeless activists.
And could you explain what materials you used to change yourself to? I mean, it seems like if you chain yourself to a fence, you wouldn't be able to necessarily move around. And maybe also talk about what sort of support. I mean, how long were you chained to the fence again?
Almost 36 hours, basically 35 and a half hours.
35 and a half hours. There are a few particular things that you might need to take care of. I mean, who was there helping you?
I had a great support crew, and amazingly, so many people stepped up during that time. That the second night was actually the second night I was there. My entire support crew that I had started with had to go get rest. They had been there for hours and hours and hours, and the only person that was actually able to stay with me the whole time I was there was Larry. But I had a brand new group of people the second night, and not only were they supporting me, but these people were also feeding people who needed to eat while we were down there. And actually, the funny thing is this is what really worried the police. It wasn't necessarily me being locked to the fence, but the fact that we had set up a 24-hour feeding station for anybody who was hungry, and that the community was bringing food down to be cooked and given out. And so this was drawing homeless people. Actually, one of the police, after the whole situation was over, was quoted on the news as saying, "We saw the situation was festering, and we couldn't let that happen."
Oh, you got to use love the terms they use to describe what they feel is an unappealing situation, when in reality it's a community coming together to say something quite important.
Absolutely. It was really interesting. I wasn't sure if they were talking about the homeless situation beginning to fester, or free speech beginning to fester. I couldn't.
We wouldn't want that, would we?
No. We can't have that. So it was really interesting that they were very willing to ignore me chained to the fence until it became a spectacle that could no longer be ignored. And when they did come, they came with 9 police officers in the middle of the night, making sure that there was no way that the news could be called, that it could be something that was caught by the media. There was still activists there to support me, and it was all, as much as they allowed, videotaped. They were able to whisk us away behind a corner so that they couldn't actually see the arrest. But we were very well set up.
And was there any dangerous fallout? I mean, you were arrested, right?
Yes, I was arrested. They arrested me, but they did not take me to jail. They arrested me and cited me along with my friend Jason, who had come over the fence. He'd come over the fence. And at that point, I'd been there for 36 hours, and I was forcing the hand of the police in order to bring attention to this issue. So I wanted to have that arrest, and I felt that I was being ignored. So we were planning on switching somebody out to continue the lockdown until they were forced to hand, so that we can, you know, bring this to court and talk about and, you know, keep the conversation in the community. So we actually had 2 arrests happen that night, me and the person who was planning on taking my place when I had to go.
And what advice do you have for activists who are interested in getting involved in their communities?
It's actually really easy, and I'm not, like, it's interesting that people are asking that question, and it makes me feel like, as an activist, I should work towards making it more obvious to get people involved, because there's so much going on right now, so many issues that really need the public's voice to be weighed in on. So really just come to an Occupy Eugene meeting, or go to a Cascadia Forest Defenders meeting, or meet with No Coal Eugene. There's so many groups here that are just doing really absolutely awesome work and fighting the good fight, and they could really use more support, more voices, more people behind their causes.
And if someone wanted to get involved with Occupy Eugene, when are the meetings and where?
The GAs, the General Assemblies, are currently happening at Growers Market upstairs in the meeting rooms they have there. And they have them twice a week, on Tuesday at 7 and then again on Friday at 6. However, the second Friday of every month is supposed to be, it's been reserved by a lot of people who can't make all the meetings, but they want to make at least one a month. So that's the one that people really show up at, and there's a lot of actual work that gets done.
Well, those are inspiring words. Thank you so much for talking to us, Quinn.
Thank you.
98.5 KHAC.
For immediate effect, apply Merge Radio liberally onto the inflamed parts of your hearts, minds, and pineal glands. Merge Radio is a Hearts and Crimes production produced locally here in Eugene, Oregon, by yours truly, Argus. Merge Radio is created for the enlightenment of all beings, to start important conversations and to disseminate vital information across the greater Eugene area. Do not taunt Merge Radio. Prolonged exposure to Merge Radio can induce throbbing fits of ecstasy. Merge Radio.
Hi there. Do you sometimes wake up in the morning with the sinking feeling that things are just not headed in the right direction? Maybe you're worried about affording college for your kids or paying your mortgage. Or maybe you're frustrated by the fact that the stable, comfortable lifestyle your parents had seems impossible for you to attain. Or maybe you once had that stable, comfortable lifestyle, and now, no matter how much you try, you just can't seem to make ends meet. Does this sound familiar? I bet it does. Do you blame yourself? Well, don't. Because for the past 40 years, the American middle class has gotten slowly, surely, purposefully, and not terribly gently, screwed.
How the middle class got screwed.
And there weren't even any long walks on the beach or fondue involved. In the 50s and 60s, a family could do pretty well on just a single income. One parent worked, and that was usually enough to buy a home, a car, send the kids to college, and retire comfortably, maybe even to Florida to become a famous shuffleboard legend. But by the mid-1970s, the screwing had begun. Most people didn't know they were getting screwed. They just knew that one income was no longer enough. So the second parent, usually mom, had to start working to maintain the same standard of living. Sure, some folks entered the workforce by choice, but all too often, it was an economic necessity. Both parents working meant added costs for childcare as the price of a home and education and healthcare began to skyrocket. By the 1980s, even with two incomes, the average American family still couldn't make ends meet. What could they do? Well, most people thought, if we just work harder. So, both parents started working longer and longer hours, creating an army of latchkey kids. But even that wasn't enough to keep up. Middle-class families were left with no choice but to take out huge loans to pay for college and housing. Eventually, they were forced to put health care, their car, even basic living expenses on credit. So where did this leave the average American middle-class citizen? Screwed. Shafted. Fearing for their finances and fearing for the future of their children. And very, very deep in debt. Because while the middle class was busting its collective ass to keep up, a certain small percentage of our citizens were getting very, very rich indeed. That's right. The game was rigged. For the last several decades, the people in charge have made a dramatic shift from the values and policies that made our country great. Instead, they've set policies that rewarded the rich and stuck working families with the bill. Let's talk about a little thing called income equality. Back in the good old days, the CEOs earned maybe 15 to 20 times more than their workers. Today, they're making an average of 300 times more. This is crazy, you say. How could they have gotten away with this? Well, it certainly wasn't by putting America's interests first. One way the big corporations started earning more money was by eliminating jobs in the U.S. and taking them overseas. CEOs complained that American wages were too high, so they moved the jobs to countries with no minimum wage or no rules to protect worker safety or the environment. The CEOs also worked hard to give unions a bad name. It's easy to forget that a lot of the rights we take for granted, like weekends and 40-hour work weeks, were won by the unions. But despite that crucial legacy, the number of union members has dropped off dramatically. So now when CEOs want to force lower wages, cut benefits, ship more jobs overseas, and give themselves huge raises, there's no one there to fight back. It turns out that without the collective bargaining power of unions, we all just get easier and easier to screw.
Taxes!
And what about taxes? In the days of Leave It to Beaver, the idea that the very rich could afford to pay more in taxes than the middle class was accepted on a bipartisan level. Presidents from Eisenhower to Nixon believed in progressive taxation as a matter of simple equity and justice. But taxes for the richest Americans have come down at a continuous clip since the 1960s, which would be fine, except that the middle class has been left to pick up the tab. Are you starting to recognize a trend here? That's right. It turns out there's a reason the rich get richer, mainly because they're not paying their fair share. For instance, while a hedge fund manager is making millions, he's likely paying a lower tax rate than his secretary who's making thousands. And major companies like ExxonMobil, BP, KPMG, and hundreds of others make billions each quarter, but somehow don't end up with any tax liability at the end of the year. How do they accomplish this? By sending high-priced lobbyists to Washington, D.C. to help rewrite the tax code. Those crafty devils. Look, Wall Street is all about investments. And probably one of the most lucrative investments they've ever made has been in Washington, D.C. Over $1 million a day on lobbying alone. And that investment in the form of these lobbyists has been really productive. Not only have they made their taxes disappear, but they've changed the whole rule book on what's legal. Before the crash, the rush to make outrageous profits with no threat of regulation led to more creative investment products. As a result, lending became more and more predatory, which led to a gold rush mentality until the bubble inevitably burst. And at the same time they were making these dubious investments, the big banks developed a business model designed to fleece every last penny from their customers. That meant $40 overdraft fees and outrageous interest rates. It meant charging $3 to use another bank's ATM when the actual cost to them was pennies. Back in the day, we had laws that kept banks from charging outrageous interest rates and actually protected consumers. So here we are, totally screwed. It wasn't an accident, and it wasn't destiny. The middle class were slowly shafted by the richest 2%, a small group of powerful, wealthy people and corporations who were able to make the government work for them and not the vast majority of the American people. Feel like fighting back? I thought so. Well, look, there are a lot of very rich, powerful people who have really enjoyed f***ing everyone over and buying new yachts and third vacation homes. And since those people are the ones who got us here, it's not going to be their theories that lead us out of this mess. The solutions are going to have to come from all of us. We're going to have to rebalance the tax code to make sure that rich folks are paying their fair share. We're going to have to fix the laws that let Wall Street play by one set of rules while the rest of us play by another. We're going to have to make health insurance and a college education a lot more affordable for middle-class families. And that's just a start.
How the middle class rebels.
It's a big challenge. But the good news is, there are a heck of a lot more of us than there are of them. And that means we can win this battle. We won't get screwed sitting down, or standing up for that matter, or in any other weird position. In fact, screw them and their greedy, short-sighted thinking that got us here. It's time for all of us to rebuild the American dream and make it accessible for everybody. So I want to hear from you. What do you think politicians should do to get the system working for the middle class? Please sign up to take part in the Rebuild the Dream meetups on July 16th and 17th. Change is going to have to come from us. I'm ready to get to work on this, and I hope you'll join me.
Hello, Eugene. I'm standing here right next to the Kiva. And as often the case, there are some wonderful musicians sitting out here on the corner playing their music. What was your name?
This is Sid.
I'm Helen.
Sid and Helen. Okay, now what instrument are you playing here?
I am playing the saw.
Playing the saw. How fantastic. And how about you?
I've got an accordion.
Thank you, Helen. All right, so we've got... Do you guys have a band name?
Yes, our band is the Grave Robin Scoundrels.
The Grave Robin Scoundrels. How amazing that sounds. All right. That was amazing. What do you call that song?
Oh, what?
What's the name of that song?
Yeah, we're not really named, actually. Yeah, we haven't named it. So
you don't generally name your songs? You just kind of play them?
Yeah, as of now, we're kind of working on putting lyrics together and song names and things like that so we could put, you know, a CD together. But
And why Eugene? Why are you here in Eugene?
Well, I'm from here originally. And this is where we met. We've been traveling on and off for the past 2 years, like hitchhiking around, but we decided we wanted to settle down here.
And what types of places have you been across the country?
Well, the farthest we've been is North Carolina.
Asheville.
But yeah, Asheville. I didn't like Asheville as much as I like Wilmington, though. I like the coast.
And any favorite places that you've been that you'd like to share about?
I don't know. One of my favorite places to go is Port Townsend. That's just up in northern Washington. It's a nice little town.
Yeah, I love Port Townsend. Yeah, I love Port Townsend, too.
Okay, well, let's hear the next song, please.
Yeah. How about that Polish one? Thank you.
Wow, fantastic. So what made you decide to take up the accordion?
Well, I never really thought about playing the accordion until I went and saw a man named Jason Webley play at the Waha, like probably like 2-3 years ago. And it kind of just spoke to me, you know. I went through a lot of instruments before, and I don't know. I really just like this one. It's really easy for me because everything's kind of laid out there, you know.
And the saw, how do you recognize tones on the saw? Is it like a fretless instrument of some sort, or how does it work?
Well, you have to have a very keen ear, and you tune it to a piece of music that you're playing to, or you could play it by itself, but you just have to be able to recognize tones, like, pretty distinctly.
And is there a particular kind of saw that is quite excellent for this, or is there any saw will do, or?
Yeah, the one I got right now is particularly good for it. It's an older saw. It's a Distin, which, because different metal alloys, you know, make different sounds, so, like, the older ones are better. This is a Distin.
And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind telling me just, like, what traveling life is like, traveling around the country. Do you have a vehicle? Are you hitchhiking? How are you getting through?
Hitchhiking. We hitchhike around, and it's a lot of fun, you know. Sometimes we hit some snags, but for the most part, it's a blast.
Were there times that you felt unsafe on the road, that there was imminent danger? That I guess that's part of the excitement, but if you have a story, that'd be wonderful.
No, I've really never felt like we were in danger, you know. I mean, since a big guy, like, I don't think you'd want to mess with, like, someone who's 6'5" with a saw.
That's an excellent point. For those who would be interested in the traveling lifestyle, what would you recommend? I'll ask you both.
What, recommend?
Yeah, like, how do you make it work? For some folks, that seems like crazy to not have a house. How does that, you know?
You just got to kind of learn how to make do with less, you know. You kind of got to be resourceful. Like, it's easier if you've got instruments because you can just post up in a city anywhere pretty much and make money, you know. But it's a lot harder for panhandling, so I would, like, imagine, like, if you wanted to travel and hitchhike around, like, take an instrument. You'll get pretty good pretty fast, you know. You'll never be bored, you know. It's just a lot more fun. You meet cooler people that way.
Yeah. Anything else to add?
No, I think she's got it. Bring an instrument.
Cool. All right, then. One more song?
Yeah.
Well, thank you two so much.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
You too, man.
And this is 98.5 KHAC Merge Radio.
Merge Radio is a Hearts and Crimes production produced locally here in Eugene, Oregon, by yours truly, Argus. Merge Radio is created for the enlightenment of all beings, to start important conversations, and to disseminate vital information across the greater Eugene area.
You're listening to Merge Radio with Argus, 98.5 KHAC.
So I'm standing here in front of the bookmobile, Gertie. A bookmobile that is set to deliver free books to Eugene and Springfield. The man who runs the bookmobile, his name is Ezra, and we're going to talk to him about why he does what he does. This segment's called Books for the People, and I'm opening the door now. The sign says, "Watch your step by, do so gratefully and thankfully." And we have, right here next to the driver's seat, a sign that says, "Why Cheap Art Manifesto." People have been thinking too long that art is a privilege of the museums and the rich. Art is not business. It does not belong to banks and fancy investors. Art is food. You can't eat it, but it feeds you. Art has to be cheap and available to everybody. It needs to be everywhere because it is inside of the world. Art soothes pain. Art wakes up sleepers. Art fights against war and stupidity. Art is for kitchens. Art is like good bread. Art is like green trees. Art is like white clouds and blue sky. Art is cheap. Bread and Puppet Glover, Vermont, 1984.
Yeah, the bread and puppet thing. I actually grew up watching these guys, you know, do their domestic resurrection circus. It's really something to see.
And in the back, there is a sign that says, "Banned Books." These books have been banned in the United States. "Death of a Salesman" by Arthur Miller. "Catcher in the Rye" by J.D. Salinger. "Of Mice and Men," John Steinbeck. "This is Your Life. Do what you love and do it often. If you don't like something, change it. If you don't like your job, quit. If you don't have enough time, stop watching TV. If you are looking for the love of your life, stop. They will be waiting for you when you start doing things you love. Stop overanalyzing. Life is simple. All emotions are beautiful when you eat. Appreciate every last bite. Open your mind. Open your arms and heart to new things and people. We are united in our differences. Ask the next person you see what their passion is and share your inspiring dream with them. Travel often. Getting lost will help you find yourself. Some opportunities only come once. Seize them. Life is about the people you meet and the things you create with them. So go out and start creating. Life is short. Live your dream and share your passion. Share your passion.
So what I have found is, first of all, that the proximity to the books, the physical proximity to the books, engenders conversations that do change lives and connections among people who would never have met if they hadn't been drawn to Gertie. But I also found that some of the people who are on the fringe of the culture, that are cast aside, that for one reason or another, life has beat up on to a point where people are paralyzed or helpless, or, you know, the whole range of, you know, I'm feeling sorry for myself, or I actually can't move forward. They come and they take books almost to a man or woman that are classics. They go to the books that they know were tried and true, that can change lives. That's why I keep these little classics back here that they can just put in a pocket when they're traveling, that don't weigh things, that can really make a difference in people's lives. And just, you know, they can grab a handful of these and walk out the door and put them in a pack, leave them, and read them.
Classics like what, for instance?
Classics like, for instance, let's take a look here. It might be Siddhartha, right, by Hermann Hesse, right? The classic, you know, book that broke people into understanding that they were not alone in their introspection and their search for the spiritual dimension of life in a really crass and physical kind of a world. Classics like Isaac Deniz and Out of Africa. Classics like The Red Badge of Courage. Classics like Rachel Carson's The Sea Around Us, who actually started ecological consciousness. You know, classics like, you know, Elizabeth Bowen, like James Fenimore Cooper, the Pathfinder, you know, like Velikovsky, you know, who was coming into his own. Classics like, let me see, another ones that I would recommend. Like Macbeth, like Rats, Lice, and History in nonfiction, right?
Wait, now that's Rats, Lice, and History.
By Hans Zinser.
And what is this book about?
This is basically about disease and how it affects mankind and civilization. You know, so basically the folks that come, but I also find these folks have taken Jack London. They've taken, let me see what else, they've taken Theodore Dreiser. I don't think we have the other one that they've taken, which is Sister Carrie. They've taken Shakespeare. They've taken Joseph Conrad and and Edith Wharton. And my wife and I have a shelf here of books that we recommend. And as you can see, people have been taking them. Oh, I just handed this classic to somebody the other day who I could sense was a person that had an interior life but had no place for it in their world. The kinds of friends they had, the world that they were ashamed of having all this, this whole other spectrum of the spiritual rainbow unaddressed, and yet they had it. When they read this book, when they look at this book, which basically starts out, a stone, a leaf, an unfound door, you know, then...
To clarify, we're talking about
Look Homeward, Angel by Thomas Wolfe, about the story of Eugene Gant. A stone, a leaf, an unfound door, and all of the forgotten faces. I mean, what must it feel like to be cast aside, and you're in your 20s? What, you know, and you got 40 or 50 years more of this, you know, why not stupefy yourself with drugs? Why not complete, you know, I mean, why not completely soothe the pain, you know? So this is essentially, this whole thing is just an extension of what I envision for that life could possibly be. And of course there will be heartbreak, because there always is. But all pleasure is a point between two pains, and all pain is a point between two pleasures. Right now, Gertie stops at the last Friday of every month in the Whitaker at 8th and Blair, and in the nicer weather, Friday and Saturday. We also have gone down to Kesey Square, and we're there the whole month of October, and are welcomed back into the park blocks. We are also invited to come down to 18th and Chambers in the sequential parking lot. Those route stops are not yet as firmly established. As we build our volunteer base of folks that want to help us, you know, man or woman, Gertie, as it were, then we'll be able to establish a full-scale route. We did take Gertie to Toledo, Oregon, and learned the rather necessary but painful fact of life that we get 5 miles a gallon for Gertie. But nonetheless, it made people happy, and we envision a possibility of taking Gertie far afield. We also went out to Monroe, and the other thing is we have a bookshelf project where I provided a bookshelf and we keep it stocked in the sweet spot in Monroe at the Eugene Coffee Company at 18th and Chambers, and we have plans to do other ones as well. In addition, once we get our physical and infrastructure solid, we have a Books to the Homeless plan. I have people I'm talking with about creating a human-powered, you know, book giveaway bicycle mobile for books, and to go around to the homeless camps and other places and put books in people's hands again that could change lives.
So how do you feel a book can change someone's life?
Well, our friend Kafka said Kafka should be an axe that chops away at the frozen seas within us. That's a paraphrase. So I think that a book can sneak up on somebody, and rather than tell them how their life went wrong or what they should do, which self-help books often do. Sometimes books sneak up on one. And by sneak up, I mean, well, let me just tell you, Emily Dickinson had a poem that I use as a real, and draw inspiration from, and it went like this. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Success in circuit lies. Too bright for our infirm delight, the truth, superb surprise. As lightning to the children eased, with explanation kind, the truth must dazzle gradually, or every man be blind. So the whole idea is, there's choice involved. Someone goes, wow, here's a book that might, you know, let's pull a book off here. Here's a book. Maybe this person has understands the suffering that I myself have experienced here. And how did they deal with it? So all that stuff works inside the being and the soul to move around the infrastructure, to actually, bring light where there wasn't light, to crack open a hard and calcified the wounds. You know, I mean, we all come to Earth with our wounds. And we carry them, and either we set ourselves up as a victim, or we're struggling, or we anesthetize, and we all do that too. We're addicts in one way or another. I almost think that to be a book addict is probably better than to be a meth addict.
I would agree wholeheartedly. And one more time, could you clarify? I mean, why? Why give them away? It seems like with the nature of the economy and et cetera, in terms of, do you feel that it profits you, or do you, what motivates you, I should say?
We are all suffering from the commodification of the most basic human congress and interactions, and we are all brutalized by this and beat up by this. What about if we're something that actually reinforces the fact that we're all connected? What would that be like? In other words, the bumper stickers tell you to be the change you want to see. So even though I live in a world with dog eat dog, so to speak, or what's in it for me, I think it's really important to make my life an example. And that harkens back both to my, the work that I came to do, but also my Jewish forefathers, which basically said, be an or legoyim. You must be a light amongst the nations. You know, even if you have to take the hit on a day-to-day basis, you make an example of your life. Now, I'm not saying that I'm not prone to selfishness, that I had never told a lie, that I never stole anything in my life. I'm not saying that. I'm a human being subject to the forces of gravity like anybody else. But here, what I'm doing is saying, take. This information is free, and here it is. And so what if it costs money?
So if someone wanted to volunteer with the Bookmobile, how would they do that?
Well, we have two volunteer coordinators, Judy Jackson, who in her daily life outside the phone booth runs the Eugene Hotel, and we have April Prescott, who works as an X-ray technician. And both these people help put together, our volunteer package. I have vowed and promised that by the end of the year, I'm going to have a book of all the possible volunteer jobs ready. But they involve, finding an army of 20 and 25-year-olds who still have a strong back. They involve people doing outreach into the community. We need a social media person like crazy. We need someone to actually help teach us body work or do some body work on Gertie, because you can't have leaks in a bus with books. And as you notice, I keep the thing heated. There's a little radiator there. So we have a lot of jobs, and we will have an actual manual. But so we're always in need of time, books, and funds. And there are very little. We like books that look nice, that people will feel happy and proud about taking ownership of, and that they will pass on. Recently, we got a call from a local bookstore that someone was selling the books that we were giving, and that's a big philosophical point. I remember when that incident at Harvard, when I told you, that 15 minutes later, I saw some of the same books being sold. That's the other part of that story. So this local bookstore said, if you don't have a problem with that, I don't have a problem with that. My wife, who's a Buddhist, says, if you really are going to open your heart and do this thing, you have to let go of what happens with it. I don't like defacing books. Sometimes I'll experiment with stamping a few books here and there. But basically, if it's going to buy somebody food or ease their pain in whatever way it does, I have to give freely. I can't actually legislate the end home of that book. I just know that in the giving, I've put them out there. I've basically painted a door on the blank and suffering-filled world and said, go through it if you want, whoever you are. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care how little money you have. It doesn't matter, you know. Just get out there, pass it on in some way. So people do.
Is there some sort of contact information that our listeners might be able to connect to?
Absolutely. They can find us. First of all, they can find us on Facebook for under Books to the People. They can check out our, you know, teenage website. Teenage meaning it's very, very young and really has some growing pains. Bookstothepeople.org, or they can call 541-520-9821, which will ring the phone in my pocket, or they can write to Books to the People, P.O. Box 5252, that's 5252, Eugene, Oregon, 97405.
For immediate effect, apply Merge Radio liberally onto the inflamed parts of your hearts, minds, and pineal glands. Merge Radio is a Hearts and Crimes production produced locally here in Eugene, Oregon, by yours truly, Argus. Merge Radio is created for the enlightenment of all beings, to start important conversations, and to disseminate vital information across the greater Eugene area. Do not taunt Merge Radio. Prolonged exposure to Merge Radio can induce throbbing fits of ecstasy. Merge Radio.